But we're going to be hanging out in the book of James this morning. Yep, Mitch likes James. Chapter 3, we're going to be in verses 13 to 18. I'm going to be reading out of the NIV. And as you're going there, you'll notice this passage is all about wisdom. And it opens up with this question that I would argue we're all asking in one way or another. It says, who is wise and understanding among you? And, you know, of course, we don't ask that question that way, but I don't think any of us can deny that our culture is constantly searching for wisdom. We're all wanting to know what life's about, how to get the most out of it, what our place in the world is. And even if we have knowledge, we need help with how to apply that, right? And so in that search, we end up looking around and asking that question, who is wise? Like, who's got their stuff together? Who's got it figured out? And I don't think that this is a bad thing. Like, ultimately, wisdom comes from God. You should be seeking that from Him. But a lot of times, that wisdom is going to get mediated through people that love Him and are living a life centered on Him, that are going to be mentors to you in some particular way. So in that search for wisdom, a passage like we're going to read is helpful in the sense that it's going to identify what a true and godly wisdom is versus what a false worldly wisdom is. And what I hope we accomplish is just give us some starting places, some generalities, like as we're searching for wisdom, help us identify people that may be wise, but also, you know, as we pursue a wise life, what things to avoid, what things to pursue. So, James 3, starting in verse 13, who is wise and understanding among you? Let them show it by their good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. But if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice. Verse 17, but the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere. Peacemakers who sow in peace reap a harvest of righteousness. When I started looking at this text to teach it, the first question that I asked that kind of got me thinking was, like, what is wisdom? Like, if I were to define that word, what would I say? And it kind of stumped me. It feels like something that you know when you see it, right? Like, I could tell you someone I think that's wise. I could probably point out to you some, like, kind of characteristic that makes them wise. But if you were to ask me why that thing is wise, like, I'm stumped. And so I looked up different definitions, read this passage a few times, read some other passages. I think I have a definition that I'm satisfied with. You can disagree with it, debate me about it later, but it also happens to be the way that this sermon is structured, so we're going to go with it. Jan's going to have it on the screen. Wisdom is an understanding about the purpose of life built on personal experience and knowledge that dictates the way that you make decisions and go about your life. We'll read it again. Wisdom is an understanding about the purpose of life built on personal experience and knowledge that dictates the way you make decisions and go about your life. So before we apply this to the text, something important that this definition does is it speaks to the reality that there's not this group of people over here that are wise, operating in wisdom, doing their thing, and then another group over here who's just like blank slates. We don't really have time right now. We're going to get to the wisdom thing eventually, right? Like, I'm going to get to it. It speaks to the fact that every single one of us operates in some kind of wisdom. There is no world where you are a blank page ready to just have wisdom written on you whenever you start seeking it out. Each and every person, young, old, male, female, rich, poor, we all have personal experiences and we have knowledge that we've gathered throughout our life. And those things inform an understanding about the world and our place in it that guides our decision making. We all operate in some kind of wisdom. It's not whether you have it or whether you don't. It's whether that wisdom you're living out of is true and from God, or it's false and from the world. So are the experiences you have, your reactions to those experiences, are they telling you a story about your purpose that's true? Or is, like, the information you've gathered that you've believed to be true actually lying to you and instead feeding you this false understanding of reality. So it's not whether you have it or not, it's whether it's true or false. With that groundwork laid, what I want to do is take both types of wisdom that James is referencing, true and false wisdom, and I want to funnel them through this definition. So based on the verse, I want to decide what is the understanding about the purpose of life, what knowledge is feeding that understanding, and what kind of lives can we expect to see if we adopt it. So let's start with false wisdom. We're going to go verse 14 through 16 again. But if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice. So let's start with the understanding. Summed up perfectly in that phrase, bitter envy and selfish ambition. The false wisdom that James is highlighting, it holds to this understanding about life that everything revolves around maximizing my pleasure, my comfort, my desire, and my happiness. It says that life is about chasing after exactly what I want. And if you ever needed an example of what this looks like, just look around our culture. It's kind of the air we breathe, right? To some extent, it's like what we all grew up learning, right? Think about these slogans. Do what makes you happy. Follow your heart. Follow your passions. Do what you love. Be crazy in your 20s. Don't get tied down. You only live once. And on and on. And TV, social media, books, celebrities. Everyone's pushing this message that I am meant to be the center of my own existence. And it isn't just our culture right now. This is kind of like the legacy of humanity. This is just kind of what we do. Bree talked about this last week, but if you go back to the creation account in the book of Genesis, you zoom in on the fall of humanity, Adam, Eve, serpent, garden, apple. It's not simply a story about disobeying God and eating an apple. It's about us deciding to take the reins out of God's hand, and we start demanding control over our own existence. We don't trust that God has the best intention for our life, and we, you know, refuse to live under the tyranny of someone else telling me how to live my life, right? Like, that sounds familiar. So we said, we're going to decide what's good, what's evil, what's right, what's wrong, and we're going to do it on our own terms. We decided to become our own gods. And there's this phrase in the book of Judges that says, everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So all of human history is this testimony of this self-centered ideology that centers around our happiness and desire. So hear me out. Christians get a bad rap for this. I don't have a problem with you being happy. I want you to be happy. I want to be happy, right? But I think what James is saying is that if you make happiness, desire, your wants, the center of your existence, the focal point of your life, that you're adopting a false understanding of reality. And it's ultimately going to leave you empty, and it's certainly never going to leave you satisfied. And the two terms he uses, I think, describe the character of it so well: bitter envy and selfish ambition. So bitter envy happens when we start to desire things for ourselves to such a degree that we not only can't be happy with, you know, what God does something in someone's life, but we actually start to resent that person. We build up bitterness towards them. We start to criticize them. We say, you know, they don't deserve that, right? If people only knew who they really were, or like, they didn't work hard enough to earn that thing. And our resentment towards them ends up turning towards God. We get upset with him. Like, I worked harder than them. I deserve to have this thing. Like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this to me? And this envy and this jealousy starts to poison our relationships with people. It starts to poison our relationship with God. And it poisons us from the inside out. Turns us into bitter people. All because other people have what we don't. Selfish ambition. We desire success and status to such a degree that we stop seeing people, right, as humans made in the image of God, and I start to look at you as an obstacle to getting what I want. I see you as like a pawn to be used to my own advantage. I start becoming willing to push you down, prop myself up on top of you, just to climb the rungs of whatever ladder I'm trying to get to the top of. This is the natural result of buying into the understanding that life is about me and life is about you. And if you don't believe me, if you don't think that's natural, I have proof. Just look at the story right after what happens at the fall in the garden, right after we choose to define our own existence. You have two brothers, Cain and Abel. They both make this offering to God. Abel's is accepted, Cain's isn't. We don't know why. Cain is starting to become envious of his brother's favor with God, and it corrodes his heart to such a degree that he decides it's a smart idea to hit his brother over the head with a rock and kill him. Which, you know, we have global news all the time. You know, killing may not seem, you know, like such a big deal, but this is the first time that ever happened, right? Like, this was the first time someone decided to make that decision. And so this is quite literally the Bible showing us that the natural course of choosing to center our existence around ourselves is a character that seeks after wants and desires. It's bitter envy and it's selfish ambition. And I think it's easy at this point to say, yeah, like, I agree, preach, you know, the world is going to hell in a handbasket. Like, if we do that, we miss out on the chance to be introspective and to make this personal. And so let's start with envy, right? How often do you see someone get something you don't have, or maybe they can do something that you're not particularly good at, and you immediately feel jealous, or you jump immediately to building up bitterness towards them? I'll be honest and vulnerable just to start the introspection. There are times when I, like, step on this stage to lead God's people in worship, probably the most reverent thing that I could be doing. And, you know, we get done, someone comes up to whoever, Amy, Evelyn, Bree, and they're like, man, like, you killed that song, or, like, you really led us into the presence. And instead of, from my position, being like a cheerleader for them and like, yeah, of course they killed it, they love God, of course he moved through them, I'm like sitting in my corner and automatically think, well, like, I guess they think I suck. And I mean, like it sounded good, but it wasn't that good, right? Like, and it's all because, like, my desire to be good at what I do, which is healthy in some respect, superseded my desire to be holy and pleasing to God. It superseded my desire to be a vessel for him. And in that moment, I'm adopting that ideology that life is about me. It's about how good I look to you guys out there, and it's about how great of a worship leader I can become, right? Or even with sports, like, I'm an okay athlete, but I've got friends that are twice the athlete that I am, and they, you know, if they run circles around me and whatever we're doing, like, sometimes I get upset. And instead of being, like, loving, encouraging, like legitimately, I'm looking for ways to embarrass them. I'm looking for things to say to hurt their feelings. This hasn't happened in a while, but, like, physically looking for ways to hurt them in the confines of this game, you know what I mean? And I'm willing to, like, say this because I want you to know you're not alone, because I think we all, at some point, have struggled with envy and ambition, and we've let it get the best of us. But whether it's a small part of your life or a big part of it, it's because we all think to some degree that life is about us. We've adopted that false understanding of reality, and it has to be dealt with. The end of verse 14 says, do not boast about it or deny the truth. When we see these things pop up in our lives, it's extremely important we don't just brush them off, right? Like they're not a big deal. It's important that we don't lie to ourselves that we feel the way that we do. Like, we have to address it and see it for the false wisdom that it is. So, okay, let's move on to the source of this understanding. We're going to go back to verse 15. It says, such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. So the source that's feeding this understanding about life is earthly, it's of the world, it's unspiritual. Some translations say sensual, or it's of the flesh, and it's demonic, it's of the devil. And if you read commentaries, you pay attention in reading scripture, you'll notice these. These are like known as the three great enemies of the soul. All evil and wrongdoing stem from these three things. And when it pertains to false wisdom, I think we've probably all experienced this, they kind of operate cyclically. I don't know if I'm saying that word correct. But once you begin buying into the world's ideology about yourself, it makes it a lot easier to give your flesh what it wants. And when you start giving your flesh what it wants, you're opening up all the doors in your life to demonic activity, spiritual attack. And once you've given that access over to the enemy, he's going to do everything in his power to push you back into worldly ideology. And on the cycle continues. And some of you may feel like you're in it and you're experiencing all the negative effects of it. Some of you might feel like you're out of it, but like, I've been ran through it a couple times. Like, I'm pretty damaged. Like, I'm beat up, right? Wherever you're at, I think we can all agree that it's a pretty overwhelming source to, like, cut yourself off from. Like, how am I supposed to avoid this when it's coming at me from all sides? And it is difficult, and I don't have an answer for you. It's going to require individual reflection, but it's worth it because cutting off the sourcer, cutting out the root, is what actually brings about change in your life. This selfish understanding about life and, you know, the result that that understanding is going to have on your decision-making. These are both symptoms of this root. And you can try and manage either one of these things, but if you don't do anything about this, you're never going to get out of the cycle. These two things exist because you've either believed the lies of the world, you've given into your flesh, or you're experiencing influence from the enemy. We have to cut off the source. So with the world, how many of you can think whatever Facebook, Instagram algorithm you have, and like how many of those reels are that you see are leading you in the direction of self-centered lifestyle? I definitely have a few, and I watch them sometimes because I think they're crazy, and I just find enjoyment in watching things that I think are ridiculous. But the more they pop up, the more I watch them, the more they start to make a little more sense to me, right? And that's the same to you. The more that you partake of the world's ideology, whether it's innocent or not, the more it's going to start to make sense to you, and it's going to start being something you're willing to adopt. You have to be able to cut off the source. Or with your flesh, how many of you find it easy to gratify some of these desires under the guise of it feels good, or like, I really want it, and you look at your bank account at the end of the month, and you're like, maybe I shouldn't have. That's your flesh acting out. You have to cut off the source. Or with, you know, demonic influence, how many of you just feel like all the time I'm being tempted to give in to this certain sin, and like out of the blue, I'm just walking in public and all of a sudden I'm thinking about whatever it is I'm thinking about and I'm tempted to do this thing. That's the influence of the enemy. And, you know, this topic in general is uncomfortable, demonic influence, but we have to understand it's real. And wherever you fall on the spectrum, like there's a demon under every rock or you don't really believe in it at all, like, We can be certain from the Bible of one thing, that the demonic, you know, spirits operate on access that's given to them. And the easiest way for you to give access is to give in to the desires of your flesh and to choose your sin. And later in the book of James, he gives us a promise that if we resist the devil, he will flee from you. So we have to resist him. We have to cut off the source. So that's the source feeding that understanding. But what type of life or decisions get made from this self-centered understanding? Verse 16, for where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder in every evil practice. So James is telling us when we adopt this self-centered understanding about life, these are the type of decisions that you're going to make. And it makes a lot of sense if you think about it. Giving into lust is really easy when I'm only thinking about my desire. Lying to people becomes pretty simple when you've convinced yourself that life is about maintaining your self-image. Deception, manipulation, they're not hard things to convince yourself to do when it's all in the name of getting ahead. Sin is easy to come by when I think that life is about me. It's easy to justify almost anything. And there's a verse in James 1 that I think is going to drive the point home. Verses 14 and 15. It says, each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their own desire and enticed. Then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. So this eventual death that's going to result from a life steeped in sin, it starts with what? Your desires. Your selfish desire to seek after things that make you feel good. And because our sins appear on the surface, these are the most noticeable fruits that come out of like living in false wisdom. It's going to be easy to walk away from here and try your hardest to just snuff out whatever surface level sin you're dealing with. And I don't want to make light of that. They are like corrupting you. But again, we talked about it. If all you do is try to cut off the fruit and you're never doing anything about the source, it's just going to grow back. We, you know, talked about cutting off the source, but that's only the first way to attack the root of false wisdom and what it's doing to your life. The second is you actually have to start pursuing something different. You can't just spend all your time avoiding sin and trying to live with this like empty cup and hope nothing gets in it, right? You have to fill it with something good or evil's going to find its way back in. So what is the true wisdom that we're supposed to be pursuing? I've spent a lot of time, but we're here. We're here. We're going to land the plane. Verses 17 and 18 says, but the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere, peacemakers who sow in peace reap a harvest of righteousness. So back up to the top, what's the underlying assumption about the purpose of life with true wisdom? And this framework, life is about becoming a person that overflows with love and compassion for people. And this list that he gives for what characterizes that life is, we could meditate on it and feel convicted for our whole life. He says, it's first of all pure. That word has a lot of baggage with it, but fundamentally, it just means that we don't have any mixture. So as it pertains to people, we don't have one motive that we let people see while something else exists behind the surface. I don't go into a conversation with someone who, like, I've asked out to lunch just to catch up with them, encourage them, while also secretly trying to dig information out of them about something I want, or like I'm trying to plug something that I hope they say to someone that they know. It means I don't step into a leadership role like this where the primary motive is to be helpful to people, to guide them, while under the surface thinking about how you guys are reacting to me and hoping that you guys think I'm great and you tell other people that I'm great. Those are examples of impurity, and a person overflowing with love, living out of true wisdom, is pure in their conduct towards other people. Second is peace-loving. And if you love peace, you hate division. You don't unnecessarily stir up division by the things that you say. You don't use your words to cause anger or drama. You don't stir the pot. And as Jesus says, we're supposed to be peacemakers. We're not just peacekeepers. We don't just sweep things under the rug, but to overflow with love means to devote yourselves to reconciling relationships even when they're very, very difficult. Next he says, and this one's convicting, that true wisdom is considerate, meaning that as you're going about your life, we are meant to be, when we're able, taking into consideration the people around us, their needs, their feelings, their trauma, and we're supposed to do what we can to accommodate them even when it's inconvenient or difficult for us. I think about the Good Samaritan, right? Like, we have this person walking down the street, sees another person, and he goes the extra mile to make sure that person's needs are met. And the story has been compelling, and it's been convicting to people for generations, because throughout generations, that is difficult and very countercultural. And in today's world, I think, and I ask the question, like, would we have been, like, so sucked into our phone, or, like, so caught up in wherever it was that we had to be? Like, would we have even seen that person on the side of the road? Would we have even, like, averted our eyes to even look at them? Or, if we did see them, would we have avoided them because it's inconvenient to help? Or, like, my schedule, I think this is more relevant, my schedule is so busy that, like, I see them, but and maybe I want to help, but I don't even have time to stop and do anything about it. And I'm not saying that you have to be constrained every time you see a person on the side of the road, that you have to do exactly what the Good Samaritan did. But I do want to challenge and say, like, are you even thinking about it? Like, have you even structured your life in such a way that, like, you could consider the needs of people around you? He says to overflow with love is submissive, or other translations say willing to yield. This is also a tough one. We have such a hardwired sense of justice and this need to be right that we get in petty arguments all the time about how things should be done, or like in church, secondary, like theological discussions, and we dig our heels in, and we don't budge until, like, I'm proven right, that person admits to me they were wrong, and even in some cases, like, you should apologize to me for even arguing in the first place. Like, but a willingness to yield, thanks to Maggie for this, and be truly wise, is to prioritize relationship over our own need to be right. It's dropping our pride and saying it's not worth it to, like, damage a relationship to argue about this. And he also says that to live in true wisdom is to be full of mercy, which means we're slow to anger, we're quick to forgive, we don't hold grudges against people, we don't exact revenge, we don't give people what we think they deserve, but we overflow with love and compassion. So these things are difficult, and just like it is overwhelming to cut off the source of false wisdom, it's going to be overwhelming to even think about becoming a person who consistently overflows with love like this. But just to provide you some relief, you're not going to stumble into this kind of wisdom. It's not going to happen because you try hard enough. Like, we need something, or someone, hint, else to get us from the self-centered mindset to operating in true wisdom. And the Sunday school answer is Jesus. When we trust in the person and work of Jesus, we receive the Holy Spirit. He starts to form you into these types of people. And primarily, it's going to happen through following Jesus and, like, quite literally imitating his life. And when we do that, we start to see that Jesus was pure. He didn't have any secret motives. He like was who he said he was. Jesus loved peace, hated division, like died to restore peace between God and man. Jesus was considerate. Several times in the scriptures, we see him interrupt his life to attend to needs of people around him. And he was willing to yield to the Father's will, even to the point of death, and he was full of mercy. He didn't give us what we deserve, but gave his life so that we could have relationship with him. And so, you know, we don't like just use the Holy Spirit to be like, Jesus is our example, we're going to do these same things. But along the way, there's a humility that comes in realizing that Jesus had to be all these things. He had to come down from heaven to like save someone like me, a wretch like me. We have to make this personal. I needed the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. I was, am still, a mess. I'm full of sin, I'm full of selfishness, and the only way out is through his sacrifice. And when you start to believe that, it changes your perspective on the people around you. You don't look at them as obstacles or objects of anger, but you look at them as fellow humans struggling through pain and sin, just like I did, just like I did in my life in the past. I'm not better than them. I want them to be in relationship with Jesus, just like I got the opportunity to. You start to see them through the lens that Jesus did, as people that he loves. And when you love people and when you overflow with compassion, you can't lie to them. You can't just dismiss their needs. You don't let them live in strife. You don't risk the relationship with them for the sake of being right. This is a natural overflow of true wisdom comes through a relationship with Jesus. So this is the understanding, overflows with love and compassion. Where does it come from? James says that this is the wisdom that comes from heaven. It quite literally comes from God. Here's a joke. I don't think it's funny. God doesn't do email or text. You have to be in his presence. I'm stupid. If someone were to ask me, like, what does your church teach, or, like, you know, what's the main thing? Like, we major on spending time with Jesus. It's everything that we teach, say, and sing, like, we talk about this. If you've been in here for any period of time, like, you've heard this. And it's because it's important. Spending time meditating on the Word of God, praying and communicating with him, worshiping him, needs to be the root of your life. Because in the same way that in false wisdom, if you don't cut off the source, you only focus on the symptoms, you don't get anywhere. With this, if you try to manufacture righteousness, if you try to white-knuckle your way to holiness, if you try to do all the things we just talked about, purity, submissive, considerate, you try to chase after the fruits of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, without pulling from the source of wisdom itself, you're not going to get anywhere. And it's because you're trying to do something quite literally contrary to what's natural to you in your own strength. And courtesy of my wife, this illustration, it's like a diet. I could try and go keto for a month or two, and if you know me, like, maybe I could do it. Like, if I had the right goals and parameters, like, you know, I could possibly do it. But that diet's not going to change me into a person, I promise you, who likes salad or vegetables or, like, anything green. The mental picture of sitting in Chicken Express and eating rolls is going to be funneling through my mind the entire time. And eventually, my strength is going to give, and all that work that I did would have been in vain, because nothing changed inside of me. I'm just forcing myself to do something. And if righteousness and wisdom isn't an overflow of a heart that's been changed by the Holy Spirit, you're going to end up in the same boat. Your strength is going to give, you're going to burn out, and you're going to question God as to like where that abundant life that he talks about is. So live at the feet of Jesus every single day. You need it. And I know we're worried about, like, along the way, making sure we're doing the right stuff, that we're growing, but resist the temptation to do these things out of your own strength. Live at the altar, and Jesus will eventually change you and grow you from the inside out. It's the only way you're ever going to operate in wisdom and holiness. And finally, what kind of life do I expect? Verse 18, peacemakers who sow in peace reap a harvest of righteousness. Righteousness and peace. If I can manage to spend time with Jesus, allow him to change my heart into a person who overflows with love, my life will be filled with righteousness that is sown in peace. And, you know, we all love righteousness. We want that. But, like, peace, I went to this small group. I you know, I don't know where y'all are at. We talked about silence with God, and we asked the question, like, what do you expect from that? And the overwhelming majority of the answer was, like, we want peace. And whether that's this absence of anxiety or just being at peace with the person I am and not constantly feeling like I'm a terrible human, we all desire this. And this is the result of getting our wisdom from heaven, is righteousness and peace. So to close, the false wisdom we want to avoid that's going to lead us to destruction and evil, it's characterized by self-centeredness and it's fueled by the world, the flesh, and the devil. And if you want to avoid this, you have to cut off the source. Practically, I think, this is just something I thought about last night, I think that it would be good if you kind of wrote those things out, right? The world, the flesh, and the devil. And just start kind of thinking in your head, what potential ways are these things affecting me? And what are some ways that maybe I can remove those things from my life? True wisdom we want to pursue that leads to righteousness and peace is characterized by love and compassion, and it's fueled by heaven. So practically, we have to spend time in his presence. And to close, for real, this is a shameless plug for groups. If you don't know how to follow Jesus, and you've tried reading the Bible, and you know don't get it, you tried to pray, you don't know what to say, stop letting the enemy isolate you and like trick you into not doing these things. We have people in this church who have been following Jesus for a while. They want to show you what it looks like. And don't wait for them to come to you. Like, go seek them out. I guarantee they want to help.